Thank you so much to Eileen and Carly. One of the things that's great about performing at Prairie is it's really a low-stress environment. Am I right? We are an appreciative crowd. So good morning, everyone. And welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. I'm Rachel Long. I'm the current president. Prairie aspires to be an open-hearted and an open-minded congregation, and we work hard to welcome everyone, no matter what your age, your abilities, or your inabilities, your sexual orientation, or family structure. Whatever your religious or ethnic background, we hope you find welcome here. We have a wide variety of services, sometimes presented by one of our own members, or by our minister, or by someone from the wider community. And today, our religious education department is presenting the program, so we'll get a good range of folks presenting to you today, and I hope you really enjoy it. Our opening words today are going to be read as a responsive reading, and they will be led by James. It's number 594 in your hymnal.
We affirm and promote the inherent worth and dignity of every person.
We believe that each and every person is important.
We affirm that and promote justice, equity, and compassion in human relations.
We believe that all people should be treated fairly.
We affirm and promote acceptance of one another and encouragement to spiritual growth.
We believe that our churches are places where all people are accepted and where we keep on learning together.
We affirm and promote a free and responsible search for truth and meaning.
We believe that each person must be free to search for what is true and right in their mind.
We affirm and promote the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process.
We believe that all people should have a voice and a vote about the things which concern them.
We affirm and promote the goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all.
We believe that we should work for a peaceful, fair, and free world.
Oh, it's on the next line. Oh, there we go.
We affirm and promote respect for the independent web of all existence of which we are a part.
We believe that we should care for our planet Earth.
Thanks. I was actually thinking, gee, they wrote that before the seventh principle, but there it is. Our first hymn today, which will be accompanied again by Carlene, is If I'm a Unitarian. Yeah, I know. This is the UU, but you know, these are residuals from a previous incarnation of our religion. If I'm a Universalist is second. Would you like a microphone, Carlene, to lead? Or?
If I'm a Unitarian, then I have come to know that no one creed can say it all. There's always room to grow. If I'm a Universalist, then it is clear to me that tolerance will only come when minds are open and free. If I'm a Unitarian,
special day.
Our chalice lighting today will be read by Madeline Arnold, and then that will be followed by a minute of silent reflection.
We light this chalice to remind ourselves to treat other people kindly, because they are our brothers and our sisters, to take good care of the earth, because it is our home, and to live lives full of goodness and love, because that is how we will all become the best men and women we can be.
Sometimes our silent meditation is more silent than others. We have a story for all ages, and Robin Proud is going to be reading that. And would you like folks to come up to the front? Anybody who would like to actually see the pictures and that... Oh, no pictures? Would you like me to hold the mic for you, or...
The story is called Answer Mountain. Long ago and far away, or yesterday and just around the corner, or maybe somewhere halfway in between, there was a town that sat quiet and content tucked into the shadow of a mountain. And carved on the side of the mountain, big and tall, so no one could miss them, were the words, "The answer is no." No one knew where the words came from or why they were there. They'd just always been there. But oh my goodness, the people who lived in that town were glad to have those words there, because whenever the townspeople had a question, all they had to do was look up at the mountain and read it. The answer was always no. Making decisions was very simple. Life went on smoothly and easily until one day. Now, on that particular day, Ma Custis was about to make dinner for her family. She just couldn't decide, because sometimes you can't, whether to make stew or steak, pasta or potatoes, dumplings or donuts. So she went out into the yard. "Should I make liver for dinner tonight?" she asked, and looked up at the mountain. And the mountain said, "The answer is..." "All right, I knew that, really. Nobody's crazy about liver. But should I maybe make steak for dinner?" And the mountain said, "The answer is..."
"No."
"Should I make spaghetti?" And the mountain said, "The answer is..."
"No."
"Should I make tacos or tofu, baked beans or broccoli, pork chops or popcorn?" But the mountain always said, "The answer is..."
"No."
Ma Custis asked more questions until the sun disappeared behind the mountain. She kept on asking questions until the sun came up around the other way. And all the mountain ever said was, "The answer is..."
"No."
Because Ma couldn't get an answer that was any kind of answer, she and her family went all night and all the next day and all the next night without dinner. Finally, Ma just gave up and made liver anyway, even though the mountain said no, and even though everyone hated liver, because liver was the first thing she thought of. But Ma Custis had had enough. She glared at the mountain and stamped her foot and shook her fist. "Why is the answer always no? Why can't you just say yes for once?" Ma turned around and stomped away to ring the town bell and call a town meeting. Well, when that bell rang, the whole town came running, from the oldest man with the longest beard to the youngest kids who still needed carrying. No one would miss a town meeting. They all came and they listened as Ma Custis told her story. "Seems to me," she said, "that we got a problem. That mountain just isn't helping us like it should. Seems to me it would be nice if it would say yes for a while." The townsfolk knew Ma Custis had a point, but they didn't much like this idea of changing something that had been the same for so long. But after they thought and thought some more, they finally nodded. The mountain would have to be recarved. Mason Sharp, the stone carver, nodded along with the rest of them. He scratched his nose, adjusted his cap, and gazed up at the mountain. Then he cleared his throat and said, "Looks to me like I could do the carving, if that's all right with you." And so it was. Mason spent the next 2 weeks up on the side of the mountain, chiseling and chipping and carving away and coming down only when it got too dark to see. And when he was done, the mountain said, "The answer is yes." Mason rang the bell to call the town together, and once again they all came running, from the oldest woman with the whitest hair to the youngest kids who still needed carrying. They all wanted to see the new sign, and they all wanted to cheer for the stone carver and his hard work. Ma Custis, who had started all this, came right up to the front of the crowd. She figured she ought to be the person to ask the first question of this new and different mountain, since she had discovered the problem with the old one. She stepped right up to the foot of the mountain, looked way up to the top, and asked, "Should I make liver for dinner tonight?" And the mountain said, "The answer is yes." Well, now Ma Custis almost fell over with surprise. "But Pa Custis told me he'd never forgive me if I serve liver again. And all my kids threatened to hide in the barn for a week. Should I really serve liver?" And the mountain said, "The answer is yes." The townspeople began to grumble. They didn't like the sound of this. Ma Custis's family grumbled the loudest. "But, well, I can't," Ma said. "I mean, I just can't serve liver again. I promised I wouldn't. Are you telling me I should break my promise?" The mountain said, "The answer is yes." Grumbling got louder, and Ma Custis, well, she glared at the mountain again and stamped her foot and shook her fist, and she turned to the townspeople and said, "This just isn't right. What are we going to do?" Once again, the townspeople started thinking. Everyone thought, Ma Custis, Pa Custis, and all the Custis kids, who probably thought the hardest of all because they were worried about the liver, very worried. Finally, the smallest but one of the Custis kids piped up. "Why does there have to be just one answer? Can't we have more?" The townspeople gasped. No one had ever thought of such a thing before. They mumbled and grumbled and talked among themselves, and finally they decided that the mountain ought to say, "The answer is sometimes yes and sometimes no and sometimes wait and see and sometimes I just don't know." Mason, the stone carver who had been listening to all this talk, cleared his throat, scratched his nose, adjusted his cap, and said, "I think I can do it. I don't mind, not really, even if I did just finish carving the new change. But, well, it's going to take a lot of time, and I can't work all day long like I did last time. How about if I work on it when I can, and we'll hang us up some kind of sign on the mountain that lets people know that the answer is coming?" And so it was. The funny thing was that for a little while, Mason worked on the mountain every day. And for a little while, everyone in town waited eagerly to see the new answer. But soon the stonemason got tired of climbing the mountain every day, and everyone else got tired of waiting, and they all started asking each other questions and helping everyone else find answers that seemed to fit. The townspeople realized that different questions usually had different answers, that sometimes the same question had more than one answer, and that there were many more answers than they had imagined. And all of that was fine with them. After a while, they thought that maybe the answer the mountain was giving them right then, just as it was better and more sensible than any other answer it had given. And so they left it as it was. And what the mountain said was, "The answer is under construction."
Rebecca, are you announcing from here forward?
Carly's doing the song. Did you want to announce?
No, she just did.
I think Carly might be. All right, so she's actually going to say something, and then I think we'll start.
Well, we're going to be doing...
Is this on?
Is this on? Yeah. We're going to be doing a little experiment here because we didn't have a lot of time to practice this, but I think we're up to it. And we're going to ask the adults for support today, okay? All right. This is a chant. It's called the UU chant. It has four extremely easy parts to it. So the first one, let's all try this together. It's on a four beat deal. So if you want to keep one, two, three, four count, it's I'm a you, you. I'm a you, you. I'm sorry. It's got a little complication. I'm feeling good inside. I'm a you, you. I'm a you, you. I'm feeling good inside. Again, I'm a you, you. I'm a you, you. I'm feeling good inside. Okay, that's one part. The next part comes on the second beat. So it goes, me too. Me too. Think you can remember that? And so let's have this half, and anyone over here who wants to, start with I'm a you, you. And then I'll help this group come in on the second beat, okay?
I'm a you, you.
I'm a you, you. I'm feeling good inside.
I'm a
you. Me too.
I'm a you.
Me too.
I'm a you.
Me too.
Inside.
Me too. So far, we're doing great. Okay, the third part is, why are you you? Why are you you? Why are you you? Great, great, great. Let's all try that. Why are you you? Why are you you? Why are you you? Great, great, great. So let's have this group again do I'm a you you. And we'll do the me too. And do you think you guys can come in with why are you you, that whole part from up here? Sure, these guys are confident. All right, here we go. We'll let them start, and we'll come in, and then you come in. All right, one, two, three. I'm a you you. I'm a you you. I'm feeling good inside. Me too. Me too. Me too. Me too. Why are you? Me too.
Me too. Me too. Me too. Me too. Me too. Me too.
Wait, we're not all done yet. All right, we need a group to say, I'm looking for the truth. I'm looking for the truth. I'm looking for the truth. Uh-huh. All the time. So let's see. How about this front group right here? You look like you're searching for the truth. All right. So let's let them try it, and then we'll do it all together.
I'm looking for the truth. I'm looking for the truth.
I'm looking for the truth. Uh-huh. All the time. I'm looking for the truth. I'm looking for the truth. I'm looking for the truth. Uh-huh. All the time. Now, if we can all get a little interesting intonation here, we'll probably make it very interesting. So you guys, you can do whatever part you want. If you like that, why are you you? Are you ready? Okay. We'll start with that half of this group with I'm a you, you, I'm a you, you. Looking for, no, feeling good inside? Okay, and we'll just keep it going. All right, here we go. I'm a you, you. I'm a you, you. I'm feeling good inside. Me too. Me too. Me too. Me too.
Why are you
you?
Why are me too? I am me too. I'm looking for the truth. I am me too. I'm looking for the truth. I'm sorry all the time. I'm looking for the truth. I am me too. I'm looking for the truth. I'm sorry all the time.
One last time.
you're guiding the presentation from here.
So I now introduce to you our, well, we've been calling her our Youth Religious Education Coordinator, but we're going to be changing her title here over the next little bit to DRE, our Director of Religious Education, Rebecca, who's going to be leading our service today, with or without child on arm.
Oh, this should be fine. Yes, all the noise from the silent meditation was both of my children. Hear both of their cries. So, again, I'm Rebecca Malfi-Eleganti, and I'm the Director of Religious Education here at Prairie U Youth Society. And I've been here for, it'll be 4 years as DRE next month. And during that time, I've heard some of the children say things like they don't know how to respond to other students in their school when they say, what does it mean to be a Unitarian Universalist? Or, you're a you-know-what? Or, Unitarian Universalism, that's a really long name. Now, how many of you were raised as Unitarian Universalists? Oh, not many. I thought, actually, very good point. See, we're learning a lot today. Already we're learning a lot. How many of you were raised as Unitarians? Okay. And how many of you were raised as Universalists? And Unitarian Universalists? Helen. And so many of you probably then understand what I mean when the children say that at times it's difficult. It's difficult as an adult to say what you believe in. So this particular year, our theme is our Unitarian Universalist Principles and Our Heritage. And I really wanted to get to the core of our principles and what it means to be a UU. And we need to start that by understanding our principles and know our principles. So I think many of you, I'm not going to ask, but how many of you, or you don't have to raise your hand, but how many of you know all seven of the principles and how many of you don't? So that's a start right there. And another thing I wanted to instill in the children was a sense of pride of what it means to be a Unitarian and also other Unitarians. And sometimes it feels lonely being the only one, you know, out of your group of friends or at your school. So knowing that there are other people out there who are inspiring figures can inspire you as well. I know that when I first became a Unitarian Universalist, one of the people I was excited to learn was a UU was Rod Serling, so I was a huge fan of The Twilight Zone. So I was like, well, Rod Serling is a Unitarian Universalist, and so am I. And some of the other people out there that I was learning recently, Paul Newman. I didn't know Paul Newman was a UU. Steve Allen. Albert Schweitzer. I was happy to hear that. Recently there was the other. Oh, Christopher Reeves was a Unitarian Universalist, and I found it interesting that he became one after his accident. So he turned to Unitarian Universalism to help him, and I read a quote about how it had helped him become a better person after. So today the students were each assigned in the classes to pick a different Unitarian, a Universalist, or a Unitarian Universalist. And we have the preschool class. They chose to do a little skit today on Beatrix Potter. And then we have grades 1 through 3 did Henry David Thoreau, and they built a log cabin in the back that you can look at. And grades 4 through 5 did Clara Barton, and they have a whole scene back there, actually, of a medical scene back there. And then the high school class, they did Will Channing. Yes. So we have a great presentation lined up for all of you guys today, and our music and our readings also are reaffirming our beliefs, and we're learning a lot, I think, already. So the first class is, I believe it's going to be the preschool class. Are they ready? Oh, they ready? Okay, our preschool class is being taught by Paula Pacheres and Patty Stockdale. Patty, did you want to stand up and wave? And yay, everybody. They've been working very hard, and I do want to say we do have an assistant in that class. His name is Devin. Is Devin with the group? He's with the group. He has been a great help. So.
Devin's been fabulous. So in the preschool class, we have quite a large class. We have Caleb, I won't say their last name, but we have Caleb and Gil and Emma and Grian and Ainsley has joined us recently. We have Elliot and Zemi and Samantha. And today we have two special visitors, Claire and Natalie. Of the preschool class, I think we have Ainsley. And Emma is here today, I believe. And Elliot is watching. He's decided not to participate. So we chose Beatrix Potter. She wrote a series of wonderful children's stories, which she also drew and colored the pictures for. And somebody who does that is called an illustrator. I thought I would have younger kids here. She's also a conservationist and a mycologist. And I know Rose and Galen know what a mycologist is. Does anyone else know what a mycologist is? Mary?
Fungi.
Studies fungi, a scientist for fungi. The preschool class did extensive research on Beatrix Potter. And although we found no clear link between Beatrix and Harry Potter, we are not ruling it out. We're not ruling it out because they both help make a magical world for children. Helen Beatrix Potter was born in England in 1866. She was educated by governesses and grew up isolated from other children, even her own brother, who was sent away to school. And here's a picture of her at age 15. She had many pets, however. She had frogs, newts, ferrets, and even a pet bat. She also had two rabbits, Benjamin and Peter, whom she took everywhere with her on a little leash. And those rabbits sure could be naughty. They would often get into Farmer McGregor's garden. And you know, if you use your imaginations, and if you try, you can hear those naughty little rabbits now. Now. Whoa. They're getting the carrots and the celery. Those naughty rabbits. What? When Mr. Farmer McGregor finds out, he's going to be... Oh, here comes Farmer McGregor. And the two larger-sized bunnies were Lynn Pawelski and Robin Perrin. Of course, it was Peter who inspired Beatrix Potter to write her famous story, The Tale of Peter Rabbit. Oh, and I forgot to mention, there was another larger bunny in there, Jesse. It was a big help. Beatrix watched animals for hours on end, drawing them and then coloring her sketches. In addition to her love for animals, she also had a strong love of nature and plants and drew them as well. Not many people know that from the age of 15 until she was past 30, she recorded her everyday life in journals using her own secret code, which was not decoded until 20 years after her death. When Beatrix turned 21, her parents appointed her their housekeeper. They discouraged any intellectual development, and they required her to supervise the household staff. Despite her parents, Beatrix made numerous detailed drawings of lichens and fungi and was widely respected throughout England as an expert mycologist. She made a set of over 270 detailed watercolors of fungi alone, which other scientists studied. Her uncle tried to enroll her as a student at the Royal Botanic Gardens, but she was rejected because she was a woman. Her uncle also presented a paper she wrote on the germination by spores at the Linnaean Society. She herself could not present it because women were not allowed at those meetings. She was allowed, however, to lecture several times at the London School of Economics. In her 30s, Beatrix published the highly successful children's book, The Tale of Peter Rabbit. And at that time, she became secretly engaged to her publisher. This caused a breach with her parents, who disapproved of her marrying someone of lower social status. Tragically, her fiancé died of pernicious anemia before the wedding could take place, and Beatrix was devastated. After her fiancé's death, Beatrix began writing and illustrating children's books full-time. She became financially independent. In her 40s, she met and married a man who cared as much as she did about preserving the land. She became a sheep breeder, a farmer, and continued to write and illustrate books for children. It is ironic that although she wrote 23 children's stories, she and her husband were not able to have children of their own. But they had animals, dogs, cats, and even a pet hedgehog named Mrs. Tiggywinkle. Beatrix died in 1943, and her ashes were scattered over a part of the English countryside over the land that she loved.
Thank you, Paula. That class has been great. I've been kind of poking my head in down there each week, and there was one particular week where I saw swim fins on the ground, and I thought, and Indy, my son who's 2.5, was running around yelling, "Ducky, ducky, ducky," and I asked James Hughes, I said, what are you guys doing in here? And he says, well, we're walking like ducks. So they had learned about ducks, and Paula had brought in these fins. So Patty and Paula had been doing a great job in the class, and thank you so much. Our next class is the grades 1 through 3, and that is taught by Marcia Johnson and Dan Proud. And they had learned, been learning about Henry David Thoreau. Yes.
And now I'll tell you who's in our class. Can you hear me? Is this microphone on? Aaron and Luna, Lauren, Logan, Emily, and Chance. And today, I think Chance is here. I know Aaron and Emily are here, and they're going to bring up the house of Henry David Thoreau that we built. By the way, it wasn't a log cabin. He built it out of lumber, and he made shingles and covered it with shingles. If you'd like to bring that up, Aaron and Emily, we'll set it up on this piano. And then, is Chance here? Chance, would you bring up, is there anything left there? Oh, you brought everything up. Chance, why don't you join us up here? Okay, and the book. You want to set the chimney up? All right. And Chance, would you come up and hold up the picture of Henry David Thoreau for us? You could just stand on the side here. There he is. All right. I'm going to have you hold the microphone. We got a lot of our information from about Henry David Thoreau from this book. It's called Henry David's House. All right. And we learn that Henry David wanted to go out in the woods and do what?
He wanted to live alone in his own house with no neighbors.
Okay. And why do you suppose he wanted to do that, Emily?
Because he wanted to, maybe because he wanted to be, like, alone, and he loved writing, and he loved nature.
Yes. So what is he doing here? Chance? Do you remember? Garrett?
Cutting down a tree for his house.
Yes, and he's going to get the help of a friend because he borrows a wagon and horses, and he borrows a wagon and horses to get his lumber out. Okay, thank you. All right, we have not rehearsed this. And he does use his friends, doesn't he? Let's pull it up straight like this. And he doesn't want to live completely alone. He wants to have people over once in a while. Here he's making his shingles. And there's the inside of his house. Chance, do you remember how many rooms he had in his house?
One.
One room, my goodness. And what did he do in that room?
Sleep.
Sleep. Anything else?
Eat.
Eat. Visit with friends?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And, what? It's okay. We're going to show Henry David Thoreau now what he loved to do all by himself. Here's friends visiting. See if we can get the page. where he's sitting in front of his house. Okay. Get the page where he's sitting in front of his house. He was what was he doing in sitting in front of his house? There he is. That's a good picture. Show that so everyone can see that. All right. So what's he doing there, Aaron?
He's writing in his journal.
Anything else?
And he is watching nature and stuff and listening to sounds.
And we can read the things that he wrote in the pen because he's left it for all of us.
Mm-hmm.
Very good. Thank you.
Emily made a little swan to go on Walden Pond outside of his house.
Now in the back, all the projects that the children have been working on has been displayed back there, so make sure you take a look after the service. They did a great job. Coming up is grades 4 through 5. That is taught by Robin Proud and Mary Franz. And they have been working hard on teaching the children about Clara Barton.
Now, we haven't figured this out, but I wondered if as we come to the different parts, maybe the young people could actually bring those around to show people, like take them between there when we get to them, or do you want to bring them all up front? Okay, we can bring them up here. This class is awesome. We also have James from 6th grade who helped us out. And they had so many great ideas that we just kept making more and more projects. And we learned a lot about Clara Barton. And it's so interesting. I've done several talks on UU Women. And over, we find out that the things we know them for are usually the things that are more feminine. Like, I didn't know Beatrix Potter was a renowned scientist. We only know about the sweet little stories, and people know that Clara Barton was the angel of the battlefield, but not that she fought to get equal pay in jobs that she had. And the same thing when I'll talk next week about Louisa May Alcott. We think we know these women, but there's often more to the story. So Clara got from her mother really the universalist values that every person is important. And the first scene that we have is from Clara's childhood, and that is presented by Rachel. Jesse brought us this wonderful book, which gave us a lot of information about Clara, and we also researched on the internet. So let's see. Well, Rachel's going to talk about it, so maybe someone else wants to hold it.
When Clara was 11, her older brother was building a barn at her house, and then her brother sort of fell off a plank and then got her really, really, really injured, and then Clara sort of acted like his nurse for him for like 2 years because he was sick. So.
And this is a replica of the house that she grew up in, which does look like that. We have pictures. So then, Clara wasn't sure what to do with her life, so they consulted a phrenologist, which was somebody who feels the bumps on your head. And that person told her that she would be a good teacher. And she did become a teacher. She got the attention of, she was one of these small schoolhouses, and some of the boys were taller than her and almost as old, but she got their respect because she was really good at playing baseball, which she had learned that from her brothers, as well as riding horses and other outdoor activities. Then she was so successful, she started her own school. It grew to 600. It was the first public school in a particular area in New Jersey, and then they decided that they needed a man to run it. So she went and worked in Washington, D.C. at the patent office, where she also had an incident where she had to fight to keep her job as opposed to giving it to a man. And then the Civil War broke out. And Jesse has something to tell us, right? Or no, Katie, I'm sorry.
This is the war scene where Claire Barton bought a bunch of supplies with her own money and brought it to the battle scene to help out with, like, the wounded soldiers to, like, make, like, get them, like, their names and stuff so they can write, so she could write letters to their family and tell them what's going on.
Yeah, she brought food, water, took care of soldiers because the soldiers were lying there often for a long time before they could be transported anywhere. And this was also something that women were not supposed to do. We have another scene from the Civil War.
This is a cabin with a cannonballs and cannon and the laundry dryer and a shirt, scarf, and a man's underwear. So it's just a cabin.
Okay. And another thing that Clara did do was to keep track of soldiers. This was a big effort after the Civil War. There were thousands and thousands of people who were lost. Apparently, they didn't even have dog tags yet or any kind of identification. And she was spearheaded an organization to help let people know where their family members were. Then she actually went to Europe for her health. But while there, she got involved with something over there.
What she got involved with is she got involved with the war in Europe, and they had the Red Cross already founded in Europe, but I'm thinking in my head what I'm supposed to say. And then she saw that there were field tents that have medical supplies, beds, everything you would need to take care of a soldier right at the battlefield, and that's basically it. And then she brought back the American Red Cross to America.
And we're going to talk about that in a second here. Yeah. Oh, okay. Jesse has something on that.
This kind of... After she came back from Europe, she decided to try to to bring the Red Cross to America. She gave speeches until she was so hoarse she couldn't give speeches anymore. Held lectures and lots of other things until finally America decided to have the Red Cross. Soon after, they used the Red Cross had to jump into action to help floods and other natural disasters.
Do you want to say something about your dress? No? Well, Jesse, actually, her dress is made from fabrics that are replicas of something that Clara Barton actually wore, right? It comes from a museum that you could actually go and see the house where Clara Barton lived later, which was also the head of the headquarters for the Red Cross. One thing about the Red Cross was that from the beginning it was dedicated to helping all soldiers regardless of which side they were on. And and then the other thing was, at first there was some reluctance to have America join the Red Cross because there was no war, and she had convinced them that there were many instances when the Red Cross could be used in natural disasters and so on. And there's also a poster here.
Claire Barton also talked to Abraham Lincoln.
Abraham Lincoln is one of the figures in the
She was born in Oxford, Massachusetts, on December 25th in 1821, and she died in April 12th, 1912, so she was 90 years old. She died in Glen Echo, Maryland. And she founded the Cross in 1881, I think. What is this there?
All right, and in our class, we have Rachel and Katie and Jesse and Catherine. We've had James with us for this project. We also have Sam and Lou and Caleb sometimes.
One other thing, I'm going to be leaving the book here, so if anyone wants to, like, check it out, they can check out the book that I brought in.
Thank you. Our whole class was very generous in bringing in the horses and different supplies, but most of this, of course, you could tell they created from just materials that we found. Thank you.
Oh, you want to take them back? Okay. Oh, we have one more class.
I just wanted to thank James Hughes again. As most of you know, we had to cancel our middle school class because we didn't have enough participants. And James was someone who was coming on a regular basis, and it was difficult because he really wanted to learn. And in this way, he is still learning our principles each week and helping out with the class has been teaching him a lot of a leadership role. So I just want to thank you again, James, for all your hard work. Now, our last class is the high school class. And I want to mention this class is, they're doing a lot of work this year. They are taking part of the coming of age program that the UUA offers to students. And we have in that class teachers are Barb Park and Bob Cape has been helping along with Ann Pryor. And they've been learning a lot about Unitarian Universalism and breaking it down with Unitarian beliefs and Universalist beliefs. I've been learning a lot when I just kind of poke my head into the class. There's a lot that I've been learning from Barb. She's and walking dictionary and encyclopedia. She's amazing. So the students are actually going to be going on the UU Heritage Trip at the end of this month. So they're going to Boston during spring break, and they have arrangements at the B&B at the UUA has a B&B called the Elliott and Pickett House, and they're going to be staying there, and they're going to be touring the area and different UU churches and congregations. It's going to be an exciting trip. So do we have Barb Park here? She's gone this week. Okay, so then Ann Pryor and Bob Cape, would you like to come up and introduce your class? Yeah. Leadership role, yes.
I was thinking while the kids were presenting, I was like, I think we can handle this organizing. Okay, so we have William Ellery Channing, and Caitlin has little... Oh, I'm Madeline.
I'm Caitlin.
And Caitlin has background info, first of all.
I'm starting? Okay.
Oh, yeah. Okay, normally we have Gavin, who's a junior, but he's been sick recently, and then Seth comes sometimes too, but we're kind of... the people that come every week, so.
William Ellery Channing was born to a wealthy and distinguished family on April 7th, 1780. His parents were William Channing and Lucy Ellery, a signer of the... Wait, no. Ellery Channing. And his grandfather was William Channing, signer of the Declaration of Independence. One Sunday, as an older boy, his father took him to hear... itinerant preacher. Overwhelmed by the fiery sermon, William felt a cursing to rest on the earth, and darkness and horror developed the face of nature. His father's remark at the sermon's end, a sound doctrine that led the boy to expect that upon reaching home, they must fall to their knees and pray for deliverance from the impending doom. Instead, the family ate their usual meal, and then his father sat by the fire, puffed his pipe, and read the newspaper. The boy concluded he should not take so seriously what people said, but study their behavior to know what they meant. But it would take him many years to be rid of his early gloom regarding religion. When Channing was 15 years old, he entered Harvard. After he graduated, 3 years later at the age of 18, he tutored the children of David Meade Randall from Richmond, Virginia. While in Virginia, he wrote to his uncle that he had had a change of heart and told him that I have solemnly given myself up to God. In 1801, as a student supervisor at Harvard, Channing began to study ministry under Professor David Tappan. In 1803, at the age of 24, he began he became the minister of the Federal Street Church in Boston, Massachusetts. He was to become one of the most influential religious leaders in Unitarian history worldwide. Channing was a minister for the rest of his life. William Ellery Channing was married to his first cousin, Ruth Gibbs, who was one of the wealthiest women in the country. They had four children. He died in 1842 at the age of 64. His grave is in the Mount Auburn Cemetery in Cambridge, Massachusetts. There is a statue of him outside the Boston Public Garden.
So I'm going to talk a little bit about some of his ideas and the influences that he had. But first of all, I have to give you some background, so bear with me on this. There's something that we talked about called the Unitarian Controversy, which I don't know how many of you guys have heard about it, but I certainly had never heard about it. And it's actually a really big deal in U.S. history in general, and especially Unitarian history. So in the first 25 years of the 19th century, most of New England was caught up in this tangle of theological arguments, which is called the Unitarian Controversy. And it was a split between the conservative Calvinist churches and the more liberal Unitarian churches that were in this standing order of